And now, let's turn to Inside the City, a weekly chat with local officials, residents, and personalities providing up-to-date and relevant information about what's happening in your city of Palmer. Moderated by Mike Malevsky.
Well, it's once again my great pleasure to welcome into the studio none other than Nate Wallace, who is still the city manager of the city of Palmer. Welcome, Manager Wallace.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
So let's start with, I guess, at this point, this is a Friday, the Friday when early in the morning as we're talking. The Canvas Board is still going to be meeting a little bit later today, as I understand, to determine the fate of two incumbents, as it turns out. There was a recent election, of course, that it covered both borough positions as well as the city of Palmer. And in the city of Palmer, there were three candidates for two seats and then one candidate for one seat. Linda Combs handily won with no opposition. And the other place, there were two incumbents, Richard Best and Pete LaFrance, and there was a challenger from the outside, Julie Berberick. And when the dust cleared at 9.02 p.m., it appeared that Julie Berberick is pretty much guaranteed a seat. She had over 50% of the vote. And then the two incumbents were separated by about 8 votes. Pete LaFrance leading by about 8. But as I understand, there are 111 votes that are going to be reviewed by the Canvas Board, both early voting and absentee and so on. And then they'll make a decision, and all certification will happen next week.
Yep. You got it in a nutshell. I think there's 129 ballots that they'll have to review.
Oh, okay.
Because the question ballots may or may not be counted. So
okay,
there's,
right.
So 129 ballots that are still up for review. So, yep, that'll start 2 o'clock this afternoon. And this isn't unusual for Palmer, at least since I've been here. I mean, I've been here for 3 years, and the last 3 years have been down to the last ones counted.
Down to the wire.
Yep.
Okay. Well, we know one thing. There will be one new face, one new person.
Yes, unless there's something extraordinary in the 129 ballots, Julie should be confirmed or certified.
Yeah. And I guess we're not going to pursue this very much more because we just don't know. How about the other part of the voting that happened at the borough level? And that, of course, was there were three propositions, B1, B2, B3. They all passed at the borough level. And the third one is the one that's interesting because it seemingly has an impact upon the city, and that is the vote to move the borough election from October to November. So what will the city now do? What's the process for the council and et cetera to deal with that change?
Well, the city does have its own election. It just so happens that it's the same time as others. So our elections aren't tied to anybody else in a sense of date. Our code allows the council to change the date if they so desire. So once the borough certifies and finalizes what the proposition is, then it'll be up to the policymakers to decide if they want to pursue anything different than the city has in the past.
Okay.
I mean, this ballot doesn't direct directs the borough, it doesn't direct the cities. But so administratively wise, and this is not in my realm, I'm just kind of on the outside, but administratively there's some things that go on behind the scenes that would require some change. So that'll be up to the council to decide if they want to follow suit, or if that's the case, then it's up to administration to figure out how to make that happen.
So specifically, I don't remember the council requesting, because it had not happened yet, from, I would presume, the clerk, kind of a staff report about the implications if the city were to remain in October, and then the council would direct whatever action to create a change if they so desired.
Yeah, it was, one, it would have been premature to say, let's change ours, because the proposition had gone through.
Right.
I think individually there may have been folks that have talked to the clerk about what are the mechanics if this passes, how does that work? But from an official standpoint, no, that discussion hasn't taken place yet.
Okay. Any time frame thought about when that might happen?
I imagine officially after it's certified the 16th. So, I mean, it's...
Of course, you do have some other things, as I remember, budget.
Yes, yes.
Well, let's segue over to that and say...
Our own election certification this week, next week, and then the budget starts immediately after that. But the council doesn't shut down just for budget, so there's plenty of opportunity to talk. And there's some code requirements that if they're going to change the date that they have to meet. So it's... Again, it's a complicated process, but again, it's up to the policymakers to direct the staff to explore it.
So budget-wise, there are increased number of meetings coming up here to ensure that the council is able to chew on the budget completely. Mm-hmm. And you seem to be on track for completion, as has happened over the years, by the first part of December.
It's a requirement that the council approve the budget before the budget year starts, which for us is January 1st.
Okay.
There's a requirement for me as a city manager to present a proposed budget, I think it's 6 weeks prior to the budget year beginning. It may be longer than that, but I have to have something in the council's hands by mid-October.
Okay.
And our first public hearing will be October 16th, and that's followed by a meeting every Tuesday night, with the exception of a few weeks, until December 11th, which is the date that generally the first meeting in December is when they try and have it approved, because that gives them one more meeting in December.
Well, let me think. Oh, no.
To push through it.
Let me think. It's 14, 11, 25. When something else happened on the 25th of December? Oh, yes. So there'll be a push for the 11th.
Yes.
I've got that. Okay.
And it's a long time. That's a long time. There's a lot of meetings to go over our city budget. So it's... a lot of places do it a lot faster, but it's good that the council gets involved like it does. So citizens should be fairly happy that their representatives are looking at the budget that I present.
I would agree. Just combining now, just circling back for a moment to the election thing, it's so hard to let go of that. It's kind of a, I guess, is there some general feeling? You're doing a budget now. There will be some cost if the city were to go alone or to move to be in November. I'm wondering if there's any sense at all of any costs associated that would be, of course, if you were to do it next year, part of next year's budget.
There's always a cost. Even now there's a cost in the city budgets. Again, I don't have it in front of me. It's either 10,000 between 9 and 10,000 annually for our current elections.
Okay.
So it's not free. We have to print ballots and things that go with that, pay our workers. Again, I don't know that we've explored the details of what additional costs could come with.
Okay.
With the way the date changes, because right now we piggyback on state equipment. This does the borough. I mean, it's the election equipment, I believe, is all state equipment. So I might be talking out my lane, but the city doesn't own its own equipment. I don't think the borough does either. So we all share or use the state equipment, and that's been because we don't have elections the same time as the state does. So there's, again, the mechanics of how we move forward. The borough's going to have to sort that out. Then we'll have to sort it out if we decide to change as well.
Okay. Of course, then... Over the horizon, maybe just a little bit of sun or cloud, depending how you view it, is the possibility of mail-in voting.
That was discussed, I think, just in general one time at the table, and I don't know that the city will move forward on that just yet.
Uh-huh. The state might, though.
The state may, and that may force a lot
everybody,
of other folks to.
Everybody to look at things. Okay. Well, let's go back and take a look at a couple of things that happened at the previous council meetings. There's one in particular I'm interested in, and which I think has finally clarified what is referred to as short-term rentals.
Yes.
So subsumed within that whole section, still, there's a little bit of a reference of B&B, right? Or has B&B been totally removed from?
Now, B&B is still there because the state defines B&B as a certain thing. So we couldn't ignore bed and breakfast as defined by the state. And that's why we, in our categories, we have type 1 through 5, and types 4 and 5 are bed and breakfast. So those are regulated to some degree by the state, so we couldn't just... And that's how we came to have it in our regulation, in our code before, was because the state has it, defines it, says it's okay, so then we further refined it for our city. But a lot of things, the short-term rentals, don't fit the classification of the traditional B&B, because now we have this term, much like Kleenex and facial tissue, we have B&B that covers more than just your standard bed and breakfast. So with other rentals that are going on, we wanted to make sure we captured what was going on today and what might potentially happen in the next few years, and still capture what is in state regulations and law. So bed and breakfast is still there, where you go in and you rent a room or a cottage or something, and you're given a breakfast. In some cases, maybe more than a breakfast. But nowadays, you may rent something, and as it's defined, it may be just a couch, a place to sleep. In some places in the lower 48, it's a section of your yard where you can pitch a tent. It's considered the same as, it's a short-term rental. So
sure.
We didn't quite go as far as pitching a tent, because camping in the city is not permitted. So,
except in designated areas.
Yes.
All right. All these exceptions. Okay. So, cutting to the chase, my understanding is that now it is possible for someone who owns a house to rent a portion of that house for a short term, and short term here is defined as 30 days or less.
Yes.
And that's to one individual.
Yes.
Or group. Okay. So you do that, and then now what if that individual goes away for a weekend and comes back? Can you then rent to them again for 30 days?
I'd have to look and see how it's written, but my understanding is yes.
Okay. All right. So then the next question is...
We encourage visitors to keep coming back.
Yeah, that's why we want that to happen. So, that sounds cool. That's good. So then the next piece of it is the where. It's always about where as well. Starting at the commercial district and running down from there through light commercial to residential and all of its different forms, if you happen to have a home that's in a commercial district, there's no problem doing this.
No.
And it would... When would it require some kind of request that would be different than saying, "Oh, sure, go ahead and do it"?
So really, it's the where and the what. So in the building that we're currently in right now, this is a commercial building. It's not a residential building.
Okay.
So this would follow different rules. And really, I don't know that we have specific rules other than what's in commercial uses.
So we couldn't rent our second studio to someone
with a couch and a bed. I think you could, and not have to have a permit, but you would have to meet all the life safety standards of a commercial building, which are a lot different than the residential.
Residential building. Okay.
So hotels are commercial, and they have to meet certain different requirements as opposed to your house.
Okay.
So this is a commercial building. So if you're going to sleep here, you would probably be considered something other than a short-term rental as defined by our code, because our code addresses residential dwellings.
So you can't have a residence in a commercial area.
Yes.
Or a residential area.
Yep.
And so on. So let's stay with the residential piece then.
So if you have a residential dwelling in a commercial zone, you would just have to, you would require to obtain a permit, and there's no conditional use permit. It's just basically you're notifying the city that I'm going to have a short-term rental in
okay.
this particular residential dwelling in a commercial zone.
Now, the other thing about many of these kinds of guidelines, laws, who checks to make sure that they have been followed? Can someone fly beneath the radar and I do some rental and I don't tell the city and I don't pay taxes and I just do it.
I would say that happens at a lot of places.
Okay.
For a lot of things with our city code.
So who do we now have a short-term rental police force, or is it no?
We have what's called a code compliance technician.
Okay.
And that keyword there is compliance.
Okay.
as opposed to Wasilla has a code enforcement, which is basically a police officer has the authority to write tickets and do other things that a compliance officer or technician doesn't have the authority to do. So if it gets to the point where it's a violation that's not being followed, then we have to call the police department and work through those channels to have things corrected, as opposed to our code compliance, we'll send letters and we'll review. And in that case, then it gets to the point where we have to take someone to court to get either injunction to stop doing what they're doing or evict somebody. I mean, it's the compliance leg. It goes from letters to the extreme.
Okay.
As well as the enforcement, it may or may not be a letter, but a ticket. Citation is usually the first thing that you get in that avenue that we don't have, because the decision was made years ago that we wanted to try use compliance. We're a friendly community.
Right.
We shouldn't have to be writing tickets to everywhere. And that, so it's a philosophy that we've adopted and we still maintain. And we hope that our community continues to comply as opposed to times change and, you know, the community changes. Maybe we do have to look at enforcement, but I don't think we're there yet.
Okay.
But it gets back to, is it happening? We do have folks in the sales tax that check Airbnb to make sure that the folks there are registered with the city. And the ones that we've seen on the website Airbnb and Craigslist, those folks, we'll get a reminder, hey, you're inside the city, apply for a sales. In the past, it's apply for a business license, pay your sales tax for properties that are appropriate, generally in commercial districts. They're very few in the city, but this also is what generated, okay, we've got some very vague language on home occupations and things like that. So this cleared up at least the short-term rental piece of that.
So when we're working from a standpoint of what is now, the sense I have is there are relatively few short-term rentals, B&Bs, operating in the city at the present time.
Yes.
There are two things that seem to be happening. One, a general shift socially toward having short-term rentals happen more and more in communities. I've noticed it certainly when traveling, mm-hmm. a lot more. So there's that almost expectation from a visitor to be able to find something.
Yes.
But secondly, having made this change, which in many ways would encourage short-term rentals, is there any sense or projection of, for example, if we go to a few to 200, when that might happen and the impact that would have in terms of income to the city, because there's a sales tax associated?
If our community gets to the point where we have 200 short-term rentals, that would be very concerning from a standpoint of what are they all doing here? How do we handle that type of traffic? I think that would, if we had that many, I think it would generate a hotel rather quickly. So again, when we make those leaps, how many rooms are that? That's 200 rooms.
Right.
That's a very large hotel. a very large hotel.
Oh, yeah, or a couple of large hotels. Right.
So the market should, I mean, it does help the city. But when you talk about one night at $100, that's $3 in sales tax. Is it significant? It contributes more than nothing. But the other side of that is if we did have 200 short-term rentals, what happened to our long-term rental market? And now where are those people that were renting long-term? Where are they living now? So that's where the it didn't get touched on much, but it did come up, is we have to be very sensitive to our community in the sense of the city doesn't provide housing, but we need to make sure that the market doesn't overwhelm, and this happened in New York City, that the market doesn't overwhelm the long-term community, the folks at the low income, that can't afford to buy a house, and now we're pricing them out of the market because the short-term rental is so lucrative. So there's a balance there, and we've got to keep an eye on that. We don't want to turn it upside down.
Of course, the next topic I understand that is going to be addressed among many is accessory dwelling units or ADUs, because that moves you from the realm of either a hotel, motel, short-term, or short-term rentals in a home to increasing the availability of living accommodations for a longer term in the city, mm-hmm. where the increasingly we see people being priced out of being able to occupy a rental, duplex, a whole house, or an apartment, and presumably being able to do to live within the city at a lower rate, but right. with all of the need to ensure that those ADUs are in good condition, et cetera, and deal with all yep. the other issues associated. When will that, do you think, come up?
So we already have an ordinance on accessory dwelling units currently, and I think that was done years ago to try to prevent R1, which is residential single family, from becoming R2, which is more than one family dwelling on a lot.
Okay.
But understanding that a lot may be big enough that you could build an attached accessory dwelling unit for a mother-in-law type setup or kids returning to the nest to have their own place in the short term. I think that was what that was done. It wasn't let's increase our housing market, mm-hmm. although that would lend to it. But not a lot of folks have done that. When we talk about folks converting their garages to a bedroom, that's not an accessory dwelling unit. That's just adding
sure.
But whether you convert your garage to a bedroom or add a second story bedroom or however you do that.
But if you convert your garage, if it's large enough, two car garage, whatever, to a living space.
To a separate dwelling that's got the facilities that a dwelling would have. So you living facility, living area, a sleeping area, an eating area, food mm-hmm. preparation area, then a bathroom with kind of four things that. And it came up during the tiny home discussion,
right?
I think a year or so ago. What constitutes a tiny home, a conforming tiny home, and those are the things that have to be there. And then those things require a certain square footage. So we didn't call out a special section for tiny homes then because we address it through building code, which you have to basically have all these things in order to be able to get a building permit to build a house.
Okay.
I think the square foot.
300?
Was it? No, I think it was 700.
Oh, 700. That big. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So, bottom line, will that be readdressed, looked at in the near future?
Yes. So, we're going through Title 17, which is our zoning ordinance, and that is a separate chapter within that chapter, a separate section within that chapter. So, it will be addressed in one form or another. Based on short-term rentals, and the requirements there, it'll have to make sure we don't conflict with that portion. But it's pretty specific on square footage of lots, how small a lot you have to, a small lot you can have, where you can put it. So it may just have to address the rental port. How do you handle, if you have one, how do you handle it is probably the next step.
Right. Okay. Well, we have a few minutes left, and of course, this is an opportunity to focus on that construction that's happening right through the heart of Palmer called the Glen Highway thing. How's that? It's obvious now.
So there's no secret there.
No secret. Somebody's playing with the road. Okay, so what do you see? This weather has been so beautiful. They've continued to work maybe beyond what they thought they might have or whatever. But it's eventually they'll slow down and for the winter and then pick up in the spring. What are they on track? And for listeners, can we expect any disruption at all until next spring?
I don't know that we'll see major disruption like we saw on Evergreen already. And that turned out to be not as, I mean, to yeah. some, I'm sure it was a huge impact for the week that they were doing that. But from the city standpoint, we thought that would be much more disruptive than it was. It was disruptive, but it didn't shut down Evergreen.
Right.
Now, next year, Evergreen will get shut down because they're going to have to tear up the whole pavement. They've done the utility relocate, so there shouldn't be any more digging, but they're going to have to tear up the pavement and then repack it. But that typically doesn't take very long. But it will be shut down, so we can see that next year. But the just some conversations we've had informally with the folks that are doing that, they fully expect to be done by next fall.
Wow.
So it's not a 5-year project that you know we saw on the Parks Highway. So we expect it to be done by 2020 at the latest, with striping and everything else for that phase. phase two is from basically the fairgrounds to Kepler, the Kepler like in the interchange. So that will follow, and that will impact Palmer as well, but not as directly with exits off the highway.
So this past year they did a neat thing. They sort of got out of the way. They didn't have to get too far out of the way. There wasn't much happening for the Alaska State Fair. But next year, when August rolls around,
there's a period in there where they have to have full access to the fairgrounds, and that's part of their contract. So,
got it. Okay. Good. Well, Nate Wallace, you've covered a lot of ground. Any last comment before we finish up?
I would say that we've had a lot of comments about speeding and in some areas that we haven't seen it before. And a couple of things that are causing that. One, the construction, folks trying to find another way out in and out of the city. But the other is, too, just the traffic. I mean, over time, traffic has increased. The state had a counter on Arctic, and we saw the count go almost increased by 15%. Just from year to year, and that's the number of cars. Now with construction and stoplights and impatience of the time, folks are taking different routes. So I just ask if you're in the city, follow the speed limit. If you're taking a shortcut through a residential area, realize that you're in a residential area and slow down. Watch out for kids, watch out for pedestrians, and be a good neighbor for those that live there. And the final piece is, because of the weather, our big yellow machine that has a huge mower on it, a right-of-way piece of equipment, is still out and about. And we're getting to places that we've never gone before because we've never had that type of equipment. We borrowed it from the state fair in the years past, and we just do the places that had to be done. So we're getting to places that haven't been mowed in 20, 30 years.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, so a lot of folks have assumed that wasn't right away. It was private property when it's not the case. So,
but no.
So we are trying to get caught up, and we're, again, mowing places where folks haven't seen before. So, again, bear with this. It's small crew. We'll chop it, and then we'll come back and clean it up. But if we are in your neighborhood, give us a little leeway when that thing's mowing.
Comes through, right. Yeah. Okay, well, thank you, Nate Wallace, City Manager, City of Palmer, for coming in today. Have a good day.
Thanks, you too.
You've been listening to Inside the City, a weekly chat with local folks providing up-to-date and relevant information about what's happening in your city of Palmer. Moderated by Mike Malevsky. This program is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of moderators and guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, the station, or its underwriters. If you have any comments or questions, please email manager@radiofreepalmer.org.